This is PCJ Radio International.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. There are many countries around the world that do expel foreign journalists. One of those countries is China. In the past 20 years, China has expelled two foreign journalists from China. The most recent was Melissa Chan. For many years, she was the foreign correspondent based in Beijing for the Al Jazeera English Network. Now, she had done a number of critical stories, including one about black prisons in China and secret detention centers. Well, after these stories aired, guess what happened? She was kicked out of China. Next, our good friend Richard Adey speaks to Melissa Chan about what it's like being expelled from China and what kind of message this sends to other foreign correspondents working in the country.
I actually don't know. I know that sounds a bit like a cop-out answer, but the fact of the matter is that the Chinese government has never really come out officially and provided an explanation. So looking at my work, you can say, well, you know, she did a lot of human rights reports. But the fact of the matter is, and this is not modesty speaking, the fact of the matter is a lot of television correspondents in Beijing did human rights stories. And in fact, I wasn't the only one who did stories such as black jails, extra legal detention centers, and so on and so forth.
I was going to say maybe that in particular, though, because you did a cracking series of stories on these illegal detention centers, which are not really supposed to exist at all, but clearly do. And maybe that was the thing that really got under their skin.
It could have been. I certainly filed a report on black jails the month, actually a couple of weeks before my departure. I also tried to interview a human rights attorney in Beijing at around the same time as well, a couple of weeks before my departure. But that's just one possibility, really. The authorities had expressed unhappiness with a few documentaries I was actually not involved in regarding prison labor in China.
But they'd come from Al Jazeera English.
Yes, I was sort of perhaps guilty by association. Some people have floated the possibility that I am ethnically Chinese and the Chinese authorities...
You're definitely ethnically
right.
Chinese.
Well, I mean, they throw the idea that I, as a result of being ethnically Chinese, the Chinese authorities have a double standard. And it's somehow okay for a total foreigner to bumble around China doing human rights stories, but that as an ethnic Chinese, I am somehow a traitor to my motherland. And they don't see the fact that I'm a U.S. passport holder as a differential. But I'm actually not quite sure how that actually fits in. It's interesting, and it's a hypothesis, and that's why I sort of backtrack and say I actually don't know why this expulsion took place, because there could be a multiplicity of reasons, and I joke that it won't be until, you know, if this ever happens, if this current current government in China falls, and I can walk down the halls of the Chinese Foreign Ministry, pull out my dossier from the file cabinet, and that's when I will know. But until then, my guess is as good as anyone else's, frankly.
I don't like your chances of that, I got to say. Did you have a sense that this might be coming before it happened? You said that they weren't happy with stories that Al Jazeera English had done.
Well, here's the thing. The Chinese authorities had not expelled a correspondent in more than a decade, 14 years or so.
Yeah, it was a long time.
So, you know, they put a lot of pressure on foreign correspondents in Beijing, not just me. And I guess to a certain extent, you always think that they were just really putting the pressure on, but they wouldn't actually ask you to leave the country because they hadn't done that in so long. So it did come as a shock to me. I was certainly shocked and had to have, you know, the first 48 hours, I was definitely a bit shell-shocked for sure, because you just didn't think that they would go through with it. And, you know, I like to tell this story about the relationship that the government has with Al Jazeera English. In the early days when the channel launched in late 2006, early 2007, I think the Chinese welcomed Al Jazeera as an alternative to Western press coverage, CNN, BBC, and so on and so forth. And they remarked as much in our meetings with them when we had those meetings with the Chinese Foreign Ministry. But as the years passed, you know, I think that they realized that we were going to do the job of any other journalist. And if bad things happen in China, we would cover it. And I think that they were somehow shocked over this possibility and have had a difficult time coming to terms with the fact that Al Jazeera English is a bona fide news organization.
Interestingly, a new study from the Center for International Media Assistance, which is a US-based NGO, which is about developing media in different countries, says the Chinese Communist Party is increasingly muscular in restricting and censoring international news outlets. And maybe I'm wondering if your expulsion was kind of the beginning of a difference.
It could be viewed as the beginning of a shift in terms of their treatment of the Foreign Press Corps. One thing that has not been really covered as much as my departure, even though I think in many ways it's de facto the same situation, is Chris Buckley, the correspondent for the New York Times, who has essentially been based out of Hong Kong, even though he was ostensibly hired to be a China correspondent, because the authorities have never given him a visa. And he's still waiting. And as is Austin Ramsey, another new hire to the New York Times and former Time correspondent based in Beijing, who is currently in Hong Kong waiting for his visa.
That's like the old days of Chinese correspondents when they all were based in Hong Kong, if you go back to the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's funny about the situation. It is like the old days. I mean, look, I think it's somewhat not fair. There is the existence of the internet and there's a lot more information available in China. But you're getting a little of this throwback, you know, with this new leadership in China to a certain extent, like, you know, over the past year, and not just to foreign correspondents, but also with the Chinese press.
Actually, that New York Times stuff, I think that goes back to reporting they did on the family of Wu Jingtao, making a lot of money, being dollar billionaires, and the Chinese government at the time being very unhappy with the New York Times.
Yeah, the premier, Wen Jiabao, I think that was the big thing. But also, if you recall, they pretty much called out the Chinese government for hacking into their email systems. And that report came out, I think, January, February of this year. So when I read that article, and, you know, it's very brave of the New York Times to have made that editorial decision because, you know, they were already under heat for their investigative reporting on Premier Wen Jiabao or then Premier Wen Jiabao. And then they essentially called out the Chinese and said, you hacked into our systems and this is how you did it. You know, that really sealed the fate. I thought, gee, you know, that's very brave of them. Those correspondents waiting to get their visas aren't going to be able to get it. And what's really interesting, you know, of course, is the actual correspondent who did that investigation of Premier Wen Jiabao is still in Shanghai. And he still is properly accredited. The Chinese are quite smart, I think, to a certain extent. They punished a separate correspondent. So it wasn't as direct as punishing the correspondent who worked on the piece that pissed them off.
Now, you mentioned the New York Times annoying the Chinese government with the story about being hacked. That gets us nicely, I think, into the work that you've been doing over the last year. You took up a night fellowship at Stanford, and you were looking at digital security, at tools for journalists who are being targeted by state-sponsored hackers. What conclusions did you come to?
The sad conclusion is that it's a losing battle. I tried to look at, there is a lot of work being done in Silicon Valley and elsewhere in terms of tools that not only journalists but activists can use to better protect themselves, not just in China, but obviously in places like the Middle East. And the takeaway from all of this is that nothing is absolutely foolproof. You know, you can install a software that will help you anonymously surf the internet or get you past firewalls, but there's just no guarantee. If somebody really wants to go after your email inbox or really wants to see what's on your computer, they will find a way. They are far more sophisticated. They're just, you know,
it's unfair, isn't it? Journalists do not have the same technical skills as hackers, just not even close.
The conclusion is, well, what can you do, right? And the conclusion is to not use your laptop, don't communicate via email, and instead go back to old-fashioned pen and paper and meet people one-on-one in person to do your investigative journalism. You know, one thing is, you know, if you absolutely have to communicate via email, there are things that you can do to make it harder for hackers. Certainly, you need to be vigilant. Don't open attachments. Don't click on links. And even if they're links and attachments from people you think you know and their addresses, but also if you're using Gmail, make sure that you have the two-step verification set up. And what that is sort of like an additional key to the door that's goes into your email inbox. And those are useful things. And also going into countries like China and the Middle East, you can use clean laptops, or even better, some people are suggesting Google Chromebooks because there's no hard drive and therefore no information on them. You have to kind of access it via the cloud. So unless somebody just grabs you and tortures you into giving up your password, they can't really access the information. And I think it's also a common phrase they use is the threat model, like who is your threat? And in China, I knew who I had to protect myself against, right? Mm. And in the United States, at least right now, I'm not doing the kind of investigative work that will perhaps get the attention of the NSA.
Doesn't mean they're not watching.
No, no. And so you sort of have to base what story you're working on and who you don't want to access that information and then act accordingly. And that's the way that the security folks sort of also explain it. You can't be paranoid and vigilant for everything.
What about you? Do you want to go back?
I'd like to go back because I was a correspondent based there for 5 years. Mm.
Did some good stuff.
Thank you. And I'm fluent in Mandarin and Cantonese Chinese, so I'm well placed to cover that country, and I enjoyed myself for those 5 years.
And it's got to be one of the great beats of the world for a reporter, doesn't
it? Oh, absolutely. It was a dream. And I'd like to go back. It's nice to actually get a break from China, even though it wasn't exactly the way I wanted to depart. The air there is terrible and the quality of life is terrible. So after 5 years in Beijing, breathing that air, it takes a toll on you. But eventually I'd like to go back. I suspect I won't be able to for a few years as a accredited journalist. I hope to be able to go back as a tourist at some point. But I think it might be a few more years before I can go back as a journalist.
That was Melissa Chan, the former Al Jazeera correspondent in Beijing, who was expelled from the country. She was speaking there with our good friend Richard Aidy. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. As you may remember, last week we were joined by Jeff White on the program to talk about his takeover, that's WRMI or Radio Miami International, of the former site used by WYFR, Family Radio in Okeechobee, Florida, in the United States. Well, in the month of December, PCJ Radio International is going to have a special transmission just before Christmas from the Okeechobee site. It will be 2 hours long, and we will give you the details closer to the date. This will be targeting listeners in North America, so stay tuned for that. Sea Crane Radio is a name that, well, many people around the world are familiar with. They just celebrated their 30th anniversary. This past week, the founder of Sea Crane Radio, Bob Crane, was in Taipei. I met up with him at his hotel, and we had a little bit of a chat.
Oh, I love radio. I always loved radio since I was a little kid, you know, listening to get the prayer cloth from Reverend Ike out of Texas on DXNN. And I moved to the woods, and I couldn't hear my distant AM signals, and I found a great gentleman in Wisconsin who makes a loop antenna in his basement. And I called him, I got one, and it worked. So I got AM stations 300 miles away, and when it worked, I had the idea immediately. I said, I gotta sell this to other people. So it was wonderful. We went on to create a couple models of our own. We invented them, even though they said it couldn't be done. So that was fun. And we soon realized that people wanted the antenna built into the radio. So we eventually did that too.
Now, the early radios that you built, did you have a company facility, or did you just do everything out of your basement or your garage at home?
Definitely out of the home. Mm-hmm. That's the way it worked until people started showing up on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. That got old. And then the funniest part was, this could be considered bragging, but it's not. We looked out. We had a tenth of a mile gravel road to our front door, and there was cars lined up to our front door. And that's when we knew we had to move.
So the radios that you have now on the market and had back then, are they all designed and developed by C-Crane, or does it happen, for example, we see this like with mobile phone makers, they'll see maybe a company in the Far East that makes a product and they put their name on it and then sell it?
Well, we did sell other radios from other manufacturers, sure. We tried to pick the best ones and market those to our customers. We did videos on how to use some of the more complex ones. But we always knew we wanted to make our own. So then in 1989, we started to put our ideas together, and it finally took 10 years later. We had to convince a company to support us to build the original CC radio.
And what kind of radios do you focus on? Is it just standard AM and FM, or shortwave and ham band and air band and all the other bands you can think of?
You know, that's a curious question, but I think it's the answer is as curious as we are as humans and our individual needs. And maybe we put like 2 meter ham band on one of our more popular radios because it's to encourage the use of that band. It also works great in a disaster. But people that I'm sure we've opened up the world for a ham radio, for people to become a ham, maybe not millions and millions, but it's fun. Radio is fun. It's a wonderful thing.
There must be some people that have said to you, radio's dying, it's going away, maybe you should just get away from this product line. I sort of disagree with that because I think that radio still has a very, very long life in it. I mean, we were just talking about this earlier, we were talking about AM radio in the United States, which is, if you compare, let's say, to Canada, is very popular.
Yeah, the senior band is doing rather well. So it's funny because TV has dropped almost in half the audience, conventional network TV. FM has dropped 30%, and AM radio has only dropped 20%. So let me tell you how bad I think it is. I think it's doing great considering all the other attention-getting media that everybody is subjected to every day. So I think AM radio is doing fantastic, and the future looks good.
And what about new radios that we've seen come on the market in the last 10 years? Do you also build them, for example, like Wi-Fi radios?
Sure. We started with Wi-Fi radio. We were the first one to bring one into the United States, a good one. And we think it's a great form of entertainment if you love radio. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, with Wi-Fi radios, a lot of people would say that, especially today, anybody can be an international broadcaster, especially with a Wi-Fi radio. I mean, for Wi-Fi radios yourself, do you see, there was a period where it was very slow in growth. And what about now in 2013?
Well, Wi-Fi radios is, in some areas, like in Europe, really went bonkers there for quite a while. In the United States, it grew rather fast. But I think it's kind of stabilized. It has, a modest growth right now going up, but it's nothing spectacular. It didn't take off like I probably thought it would and take over the whole universe, but it's still strong. Yeah, it's still strong.
Now, you've been at this now for more than 20 years.
Yes.
When you look at all this time that has gone by, did you ever think that after all these years you would still be in this business, or do you think that maybe you would have moved on to something else?
Probably a sane man would have moved on, possibly. But I sincerely love radio and what it offers. It fits with who I am. I just can't tell you. You can do so many things. I like to work. Well, you can't work when the TV's on. Mm-hmm. The knowledge you gain from radio is tremendous. It's very entertaining for music and talk and everything else. So I think I cut off my TV a few years ago for conventional network TV, and I love it.
So as a radio listener, what kind of things do you listen to?
Boy, it's really diverse. I sponsor the Coast to Coast show at night now, so I listen to that usually. I'll tune it over to Bloomberg Business Radio at night when I get home. I force myself to pick a new Wi-Fi station once a week and see what I find, and that's really fun. So it's really diverse. I pick up some of my old stations that I listened to when I was a kid, direct, not through Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. And then local stations, have some great local stations where we live up in the Fortuna area of California. So that occupies quite a few hours of listening right there.
And how do you see the future of radio in this iPad, iPod, internet world?
I think you have to separate how you listen to it from the device. So whatever's most convenient and what you like is what you're going to use to listen to it. But the audio on cell phone sucks. So we're going to have to fix that too.
And that was my conversation with Bob Crane, the founder of C. Crane Radio. To find out what models they have, you can visit their website, C. Crane. That's CCRANE.com. CCRANE.com. C. Crane Radio. Also, during his time here in Taiwan, I also had a chance to meet somebody who actually I was familiar with but never met him face to face. And I'm sure that some of you in North America and Europe who listen to our transmissions to Southeast Asia will also know. You may not know his name, but you definitely know his radio. That was Dan Van Hoy, who is the guy here in Asia who has a remote receiver in Hong Kong, which you can tune in through via Global Tuners. And we're going to bring you that conversation on an upcoming edition of the program very soon. So stay tuned for that. All right, you are listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. This weekend, by the way, we made another frequency change for our transmissions to Southeast and East Asia. As you know, we had been using 11835 kHz, but just as the B13 schedule kicked in, well, we had some co-channel interference from China Radio International and the Voice of Russia. We then switched over to 11990 kHz. But from the reception reports that we have been getting for the past 2 weeks, well, reception on that is also not very good. So we are going to be changing frequency beginning this Sunday, November the 17th. As of the recording of this program, we don't have it yet. But if you are listening to this before November the 17th, visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com, and all the information will be on our front page. You can also take part in some very interesting discussions through our Facebook page, where you can find people like Andy Sennett, Bob Zanotti, Dan Hensley, who's coming up in a moment, as well as a lot of very interesting posts from you, the listeners. What's quite interesting, though, is many of the ideas that we get for this show are from posts that people do put there. Just do a search for PCJ Media, PCJ Radio, click on Join the Group, and that's all you need to do. I should tell you in advance that we have had problems before with people posting QSL picture after QSL picture after QSL picture. I'm personally okay with that, but it's not that kind of website. But if you do have interesting news items about the media where you are, do go and post them. Now, I don't want to put people off by saying don't post any pictures of QSL cards. If it's something interesting, you know, go ahead and post it. But don't post it 10 times. All right, now time to turn over to our propagation editor, Dan Hensley, and what we can expect over the next 7 days. Dan?
Here's propagation for the week from November 16th to November 22nd, 2013. 10.7 centimeter flux starts out November 16th and 17th at 150, up to 155 on November 18th and 19th. November 20th through the 22nd, we'll see a 10.7 centimeter flux of 150. The A index starts out at 8 on November 16th, down to 5 the rest of the week from November 17th to November 22nd. We'll have a KP index of 3 on November 16th, and then 2 steady all week long from November 17th to November 22nd. Sunspots 1890, 93, and 95 through 99 are in view this week. Sunspot AR 1800, he has a beta gamma delta magnetic field that harbors energy for X-class solar flares. Sunspot AR 1897, he has a beta gamma magnetic field capable of producing M-class flares. Wind from a coronal hole could reach us here on Earth November 16th through the 17th. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thank you very much, Dan Hensley. And of course, you can find out more information on propagation at our website. You'll see it on the front page. Well, guess what? We are now out of time. If you wish to contact us and let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. Once again, mnp@pcjmedia.com. And while you're there, there is a link on the front page for the propagation report that Dan Hensley does publish, so do go and check it out. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. On behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well, hoping to see you again in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies.